Blog Talk Radio.
GoDamnMedia.com.
Ammunition. Good evening, everybody, and welcome to the Red Fox Blogger, and I'm your host, humble host, Cal Fritzy. I hope everybody's enjoying this rather chilly, dark autumn evening. I'm not having too much fun. I miss summer. But neither here nor there, and enough about me. Let's get on with the show because we have a bit of a full plate tonight. There's a few things I want to discuss with you. The, of course, primarily is what I have put in the episode information, as it were. I want to talk about Islamic forced marriages, and I'm not going to come across from a very, very sympathetic point of view. As you know, I do this radio show because I am the number one infidel, and I am indeed that infidel your Iman warned about. I really don't care for Islam. I despise Islam. And I have very little sympathy for the Muslims under the thumb of Islam because, as far as I'm concerned, they're not really doing a whole lot about it in terms of reformation. However, I do want to expose to you stories that you may not be familiar with. As a matter of fact, on Monday, I was talking about the Islamic sex grooming gangs, I got more feedback from that show. I had people telling me that they had no idea that that sort of thing went on. And I was trying to explain to them it's happening under our noses. If you had listened to programs like East Anglian EDO radio show here on Blog Talk Radio, Jeff Mitchell will tell you what's going on over there in England with these sex grooming gangs. I was doing an expose on a sex grooming gang that was busted here in Canada, and it's at trial right now. See, ladies and gentlemen, these things are coming to our shores. They are all over Europe like white on rice, and they are in North America. Canada's very first sex grooming gang. People were totally unaware. This is why I do the program. Now, early enforced marriages. I'm just going to give you a few facts and figures because I want to give you a bit of a background as to exactly what this is. I know a lot of you, my listeners in particular, are very smart. However, I'm garnering new listeners every day, and they're learning as they go along as well. They're learning, I'm learning, you're learning, we're all learning. Today's topic, however, the feature topic is forced marriages. I'm going to give you some facts, some figures, and what we can do about it. Okay? Now, at this point, today, 14 million girls under the age of 18, they're married off each year. That is 1,166,666 a month. That is 26, ladies and gentlemen, I failed math in high school. Don't tell anybody. Okay. That is 262,230 a week. 38,461 a day. That is 27 every minute. 14 million girls under the age of 18, and that's every year, and I gave you the stats, 27 every minute. How many breaths do we take in a moment, hey? That virtually is every 2 seconds. Every 2 seconds, there is a forced marriage going on out there around the planet. Now, one in every five of these girls in the developing world, they're married by the age of 18, always. And one in nine marriages before they reach of age 15. These are in countries like Niger, Chad, Mali, Bangladesh, Guinea, and the Central African Republic. And the rate of early enforced marriages is 60% and over. Early enforced marriages. Child brides are particularly prevalent in South America at 46%, in Sub-Saharan Africa at 38%. The countries that have the highest rates of early enforced marriages in Europe include Georgia, and that's at 17%, in Turkey at 14%, the Ukraine at 10%, and at least 10% of adolescents marry before the age of 18 in Britain and France. See? It's getting closer and closer, the so-called culture underneath the thumb of Sharia law. I think it's important that we discuss this. I think it's important that we face this. I think it's important that we realize that there is indeed a true and dire threat. These forced marriages are in North America. They're certainly in Europe, as I have just cited, 10% in Europe. Wow. In Britain and in France in particular. Now, what are these early enforced marriages? Well, in Africa, for example, they had the highest proportion of early marriages. The thing is, in these countries where the legal age of marriage, it differs by sex. And the age for the woman, of course, is always lower. For example, in Benin, Cameroon, Gabon, Mali, Niger, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, the legal age of marriage for males is 18, for females, 15. Legal age. Legal. How would you like it Dad? Yes, my dear daughter. I'm getting married. You're 15. Yeah, but it's legal. I can do it, Dad. Okay, now that's not a forced marriage. I'm just trying to make a bullet point here. Is that if Islam and its Sharia has its way, your daughter will be legally able to marry at the age of 15. It will be the law. That will be Sharia law. Maybe you'll have something to say about that, of course. But will your granddaughters, as parents, will they have a say? Or will it be too late by then? Early or forced marriage, it's legal. The marriage is formalized. It's a binding partnership between two consenting adults. However, child marriages involve either one or both spouses being children. This may take place under civil law all the same. It may take place under a religious or customary law, with or without formal registration. So they have no say. The parents have the say. Do you know in 1948, there was a Universal Declaration of Human Rights that stated that marriages should be entered only with the free and full consent of the intending spouses? Where one of the parties getting married is under 18, consent cannot always be assumed to be free and full. Indeed. We hear these stories about forced child marriages, and I'm going to get to a few examples. I'm going to cite something for you a little bit, but I want to give you the broad brush here. What are the causes of forced marriage, and why do they happen? Well, the causes of early and forced marriage, they're very complex. They're interrelated and dependent on individual circumstances and context. We know that. But the practice itself is driven by these main factors. For one, gender inequality. We know under Sharia, women and girls often occupy a lower status in societies as a result of social and cultural traditions, attitudes, beliefs that deny them their rights and stifle their ability to play an equal role in their homes and communities. Sharia. Poverty. In families on a low income, girls may be viewed as an economic burden. The perception of girls' potential to earn an income is comparatively poor, and it pushes girls out of their homes and into marriage. Negative traditional or religious practices. Pardon me. In many countries, the importance of preserving family honor and girls' virginity is such that parents push their daughters into marriages well before they are ready. And there is a belief that marriage safeguards against immoral or inappropriate behavior. Now, why does early enforced marriage happen? Another reason, failure to enforce laws. Sometimes families are not even aware they are breaking the law. In some countries, early marriage is so prevalent, prosecutions are seldom brought. Something I found interesting here that contributes to earlier forced marriage, early and forced marriage, I should say, is conflicts, disasters, and emergencies. Disasters and emergencies increase economic pressure on households, and many families that wouldn't previously have considered early marriage turn it into a last resort. Well, not all families, as we are seeing as we go along here. Now, what are the consequences? The consequences are dire. Because early enforced marriages contributes to driving girls into a cycle of poverty and powerlessness, and they are likely to experience violence, abuse, and forced sexual relations. Women who marry younger are more likely to be beaten and to believe that husbands can justify it. Poor sexual and reproductive health. Child brides are more likely to contract HIV than their unmarried counterparts because of their greater sexual exposure, often with an older husband who, by virtue of his age, is more at risk of being HIV positive. And I'm going to pause it right there for a minute. Keep that one in mind. In Africa, that is prevalent. Young girls married off to older men, and the older men go off, and they carry on with their traveler brides. They contract all sorts of sexually transmitted diseases, HIV, of course, being the most prevalent. There is illiteracy and lack of education because girls tend to drop out of school shortly before or when they get married. There is a commonplace view that once a girl is married, she has crossed the threshold into adulthood and no longer needs an education. See that? So forget university, Fatima. Sorry. I put a picture in the slides up there about the show notes, guys. If you want to scroll up and take a look, there is one in there I put, and that is of a young girl, and she doesn't look too darned happy. Married at 9, a mother by 11. Yeah, it's so great to be a Muslim. So what are we going to do about it? You know what? There is not a damn thing we can do about it. Because I, for one, I'm not willing to go over there and change the world and sing kumbaya and let's break out the rainbows. No, because that is an impossibility. It is not going to happen. It's happening over there. It's prevalent. I gave you the stats. We can't change it over there. You want to reform Islam? Do you want to reform Sharia law? Do you want to take away their Sharia law? Well, good luck with all that, because it ain't going to happen. But what I want to do is apprise you of how prevalent it is. And if I use that word prevalent one more time, I'm going to have to hit the ding, ding, ding glass as if I'm at Toastmasters. But it is happening here. It is amongst us here. Right now, it is confined to those who practice Islam, whether it be in Canada, the United States, Great Britain, wherever, it's confined. But what about down the road? What about when Muslims start getting their ways, as we're seeing right now? We are seeing it in our institutions. We are seeing it in our governments. What if things start becoming law? What about forced conversion? What about two generations from now if Islam continues to gallop along the way it is right now? By then, it will be way too late because the camel's nose is right there. The camel is sniffing in our tent right now. People call me an alarmist. No, I'm a realist. This is going on, and it is coming here. I don't know what to do to prevent it over there. I don't, quite frankly, I'm not too concerned about it over there because it is what it is. And like I say, it's not going to change. You're not going to get a group of Christians going over there and wagging their finger and saying, what you're doing is bad, bad, bad. Because that finger will just be bitten right off. And we know that. So we have to be realistic. But what we can do is stop it right here before it gets too far out of control. We are already seeing incidences of Islam getting its way and gaining its way within our constitutions. We see how they work around that. We see the civilization jihad all around us, and in the United States in particular with that usurper-in-chief named Barack Hussein Obama planting Muslim Brotherhood into higher echelons of the White House. Political jihad. Civilization jihad. And the numbers will grow. And your grandkids will never know what democracy was. And Christianity and Judaism may be a fairy tale. So what can we do about it? Talk about it. We have to talk about it. We have to be aware of the plans that Islam has in store for us with the caliphate. I have another article here, but I had something here I wanted to share with you as well, and I'm just going to bring it up. Yeah, I told you I would relate a case study. I think everybody's heard about that 8-year-old girl in Yemen who bled out on her wedding night because she was married to a 40-year-old man. Apparently her name was Rowan. And she died from torn genitals and severe bleeding. And she died in Yemen in the northwest city of Hart. She was 8 years old, raped on her wedding night, and bled out. I'm not going to share with you too many details about that. I think you can use your imagination and come to your own conclusions. But let me also include this. This 40-year-old, the penetration wasn't going too well because, well, she's 8 years old. Penetration wasn't quite working out for him. So he decided to use some devices to make penetration just a little easier. So you can imagine the torture that this 8-year-old suffered at the hands of this brute. So what am I going to do? Am I going to go over to Yemen? You stop it right now. That's bad. You're a bad, bad man. Are you kidding? I'd be hanging by a crane within the hour. But we can stop it here. I always ask you, how much more of Islam are you willing to tolerate? And we had the Human Rights Watch. They had the reports. You know, do you know that 14% of girls in Yemen are married before the age of 15? 82, definitely before they're 18. And like I said before, Yemen is gripped in poverty. Poor families, they find themselves unable to say no to bride prices. Yeah, selling your 8-year-old daughter when you're living in abject poverty as an avenue to put food on the table is rather enticing, isn't it? But it, like I'm telling you, ladies and gentlemen, it's so much more complex than that. We've got the tribal customs as well. There are beliefs that a young bride, she can be shaped into an obedient wife. She can bear more children and be kept away from temptation. Yeah. See? Obedient wife and bear more children. What I take away from that, bear more children? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pop out those shaheeds, lady. Come on. Give me male shaheeds. Let's go. Well, they do have disproportionately more children. In 2010, a 12-year-old girl passed away after struggling for 3 days in labor, attempting to give birth. Married by 9, a mother by 11. I guess 12 in this case. Well, where are the parents in this? Well, I'm telling you, they're right there. A lot of factors play into forced marriages. However, they're not always married off to strangers. Like in the case of this little girl, Rowan. More often than not, they're married to their cousins. That is consanguineous marriage. They are consanguously married. I think I just made up a new word. I'm not too sure. but they marry their first cousins. That creates all sorts of health issues as well, because that, of course, is interbreeding. Or not even inter, it's inbreeding. That creates all sorts of psychosocial, physical, mental health issues. And that is something that we have to pick up. You see, they are living in the West, and they're sending their daughters and sometimes their sons off to marry, arranged marriages, forced marriages, and they're usually marrying their first cousin. And they come back to the United States or Canada with their cousin. They're sponsoring a cousin. Isn't that interesting? And they're having children. And these children have health issues. And we're picking up the tab. You think Obamacare is going to kill you now? Give it a generation if this gets out of hand down the road. It's cost a lot of money to keep on top of this as well. It's a headache. Like, it's a monetary headache. We've got all of these programs out there, awareness programs, campaigns. We've got groups like UN Watch and all sorts of them out there. We have the extra headaches at the airports, the border patrols. Do you know that the border patrols are being trained on how to spot when a young girl is boarding a plane to engage either in female genital mutilation or forced marriages? Yes. These are workshops. And that costs money. These workshops, they cost money. Isn't it something that we have to have programs for our Border Patrol agents to spot something? Is amiss when that little girl is boarding the plane. She may be 8 and she's going on family vacation to Pakistan. They are told, be especially aware of families traveling over summer vacation. And that is true. The kids are out of school. Hey, guess what, kids? We're going to Yemen. Pack your bags. And we have to look for it. It's up to us to patrol this. See, they come over here because it's just fantastic. We have a wonderful welfare system, and we are such a generous democracy. But they're not letting go of all those customs, not by a long shot. And they want us to be culturally sensitive to this. I'll be damned. I'm not going to be culturally sensitive to it, because quite frankly, I'm sick and tired of it. They come over here, they won't assimilate. They bring their rudimentary, backwards, backwater customs with them. And it does affect us. We're not under Sharia law, but it still affects us. It affects us in our tax dollars, because we have to be apprised of this, and we have to look out for this, and we have to put up with the ramifications when things go wrong, i.e. a health-afflicted child born of two cousins. It cost us in medical. It cost us in social programs. It cost us at the airports. It cost us in our schools. I feel really bad for these little girls. But what am I going to do over there? I can't do anything over there. They're not going to listen to me. They're not going to listen to you. They're not going to listen. They don't listen to our governments. They don't listen to the useless nation, which is a joke anyway. It goes on and on and on. For goodness sake. I'm just going to pop in into the chat room and say hello to people. And hey, I've got people filing in here. I want to thank you guys for being here. I've got Iggy Mom. I got AGD. Agador is here. Drake's Drum. Thanks. Jeff of East Anglian's EDL radio show. Jeff, your ears must have been burning. Lady Michelle, Paul Alexander, Sino Radio, Vorpalbite is here. And I have Sue from New Mexico who is joining me on the line. And Stephen Vandergast was here a little earlier. And Steve Vandergast, he's actually helping me work on something. He does a lot of voiceover work. He's the man kind of behind the scenes, and he's helping me out with something right now. He is indeed the voice, and he is the man behind the curtain.
The great Oz has spoken. Pay no attention to that man behind the curtain.
So, Stephen, thanks for your help. I want to play something here for you. This is a clip of a woman living in the United States who was forced to undergo an arranged marriage. Now, she's living in the States right now. She was actually living in the States before. She was in the my apologies. I got a pop-up here. Okay, Cal, get your bearings. There you go. It's all good. She was living in the United States. She emigrated here. And next thing you know, she's on a plane on her way into an arranged marriage. She got out of it, but she never did forgive her mother for arranging it. And I'm just going to bring it up for you. I want you to take a listen to what she has to say.
I remember the day my mom called me and said, there is this marriage proposal for you from America. I'm like, what? And she would cry, and she would sob, and she's like, you must accept. I don't care what you do when you get there, you must accept. And it just broke my heart to see my mom in pain. And so I accepted a marriage proposal from a stranger. And I remember vividly, I remember how landing in the airport, coming to the airport, seeing him and like having anxiety like at the first look. And the irony is, here is the Iraqi American in America. I was in a marriage in America. And he did every single thing my mother told me not to accept throughout my whole life. Not to accept someone touching you the wrong way, he touched me the wrong way. Not to expect someone to talk with you in the wrong way, he talked to me in the wrong way. Be independent, he was everything about me being dependent. Everything, all the rules and the instructions were the reverse with this guy. And on top of it, Iraq invaded Kuwait only a month and a half or so after I arrived here. And my family were completely cut off. I couldn't reach them. I couldn't tell them. This is a horrible marriage. You got me into it. Was very upset at my mother for the longest time. Actually, I did not forgive my mother until about a year before she died. And I did not fully understand that this woman did no different than the woman I often meet in my work later on in my life, who offered me their daughter and said, take her, maybe you'll give her a better life than I can in this world. She used the tools she had to save me.
And that was Zainab Salbi. Oh, man, I had to hit my cough button. I've had this frog in my throat that's been driving me crazy ever since I came on the air. But that was Zainab Salbi, and she is with an organization in trying to prevent forced child marriages. How you do it, I do not know. And quite frankly, I'm sorry that this goes on, but we're not in a position to go over there and change things. They don't want change. Islam will not reform. It refuses to change its ways. I just want to bring it up because I'm sick of it happening here. See? This young lady, Salbi, Zainab Salbi, living in the United States, sent overseas into a forced marriage. It does dent our society. Don't think it doesn't. It does. It affects us. They're getting their footholds any way they can with the Sharia. They're trying to push it onto our kids in our schools. And this is something else. Islam, it being a cult, is a master at brainwashing. A couple of months back, I was reading an article. And this was out of a high school in flyover territory, Middle America. And it involved a mother and her concern about the curriculum in her daughter's high school. You guys may recall that. I did bring it up a few months back. But the mother was concerned about what her daughter was learning. She was horrified to find out that her daughter was told to wear a burqa in one of her classes. It could have been world religions, who knows. The mother didn't know about this. It was the mother's girlfriend told her. The mother asked her, what exactly are they teaching you in this course? And the daughter, I think she's 14 or 15, could have been at the time, maybe still is. The daughter turned to her and said, well, we're learning that Islam is a religion of peace and that it's being persecuted. See? Little Christian girl being force-fed this garbage. Get your kids out of public school. There was another case not too long ago where a mother had to approach the school board because they were showing this show, I think it's called Muslim in America. It was about 30 minutes long, and it was nothing but prophet. It was proselytizing. It's all it was doing was proselytizing the students. And the mother had to make demands for them to pull it from the curriculum because it was nothing more than Islamic propaganda. She was getting nowhere. And finally, she went to American Law for American Courts. And they helped her. And they finally got that 30-minute video from the curriculum pulled. But that is the struggle that we put up with. We cannot even have a say in our own school boards about what our children are being taught in the classrooms. We have to go to these organizations and get help. Our voices are not welcome at the parent-teacher association meetings. We are told that we are being discriminatory. We are told that we are racist. We are told that we are Islamophobes. And we are told that it is not our place on how our children are being taught in our schools. Is this what you had in mind for your child? Is this what you want for your grandchildren? Don't mind me. I got something going on here. Don't know what that is, but... And... all these Arab Springs we keep hearing about, oh, please. There are Muslims who really do want reform, who truly want reform. We're seeing it in Egypt. We're seeing it in Tunisia. But sometimes do you think it's just better to stick with the devil that you do know? Now, what happened in Egypt, the so-called Arab Spring, right? They got rid of Morsi. Mubarak. They got rid of Mubarak. They put in Morsi. They got rid of Morsi, and now they've got Rouhani. Hassan Rouhani is supposed to be some sort of visionary reformist. Not so bloody fast. Back up the truck, folks. because, you know what? Where am I getting myself here? I'm getting myself mixed up. Hassan Rouhani is in Iran, so my apologies. I said Egypt. There we go. I'm just correcting myself right here, right now. So this is out of Iran. Yeah, they got rid of Ahmadinejad, and they installed Rouhani, who was supposed to be the great white savior there in Iran. No, it's not happening, folks. Because apparently there is a new law in Iran that will allow men to marry their adopted daughters at the age of 13. Yeah. And President Hassan Rouhani of Iran is going for this. He says, yeah, it's fine. Even Ahmadinejad didn't go for that, as far as I know. I mean, the guy was a barking mad tyrant. But I don't think this was something that he would have had on his political plate, unlike Rouhani. This guy is being hailed as a new moderate voice in this government. No, he's fine with this new law. Yeah. Men can marry their adopted daughters at the age of 13. This law was approved by the Iranian members of parliament, and it maintains that girls can marry with the permission of their father at the age of 13 and young boys at the age of 15. I'm sorry, I have to catch my breath here. I read this stuff every day, and I still come up breathless. Now, apparently the timing of the law being passed through, it's the first legal hurdle. And it comes just days after Rouhani's landmark phone call to President Hussein Obama. And I don't know if you're aware, my American listeners certainly are, but that was the first exchange between the two countries in 34 years. The first time an American president has spoken with a representative out of Iran in 34 years. There's a lawyer by the name Shadi Seder. He works for a group, Justice for Iran. He said that this bill is legalizing pedophilia. And he's correct. It's not part of the Iranian culture to marry your adopted child. Obviously, incest exists in Iran, more or less, as it happens in other countries across the world. But this bill is legalizing pedophilia and is endangering our children and normalizing this crime in our culture. Iranian officials, they argue that the question of fathers marrying their adopted daughters comes out of practicality, since adopted girls are forced to wear a hijab around their fathers and mothers must wear it around their adopted sons. So why not marry her, right? I'm going to talk about the niqab in a minute. There's something with you I want to share. I'll do that. I'm going to take a break in a minute. I'll do that after the break. Sadir argues, though, and actually it's a miss. I called her a mister. Ms. Sadir argues that it is just a legislative ploy to get around the normal bounds of paternal relationships, with the sexual aspect of a marriage still in full play, even though it is publicly downplayed. With this bill, you could be a pedophile and get your bait in the pretext of adopting children. Wow, absolutely correct is that one is. Adopt a girl, get your bait, and it's all legal. As young as 13 in Iran. Iran, they also have a very real concern about underage marriage. There was a report that there were 42,000 children between the ages of 10 and 14 who were married in 2010. If this bill passes through the final legal hurdles to become enforceable, the law will become as a step back. And this in a recent period of apparent modernization of Iran. We thought after Ahmadinejad stepped down from power there in August, Rouhani would have made clear efforts to be considering progressive moves and strike us as a progressive leader. He even launched a Twitter account. Yep. Had himself an old Twitter account set up there to make it visible to the Iranian public for what he was up to. An official Twitter account. Wow. I was listening to those speeches at the United Nations this week. I was listening to Minister of Foreign Affairs John Baird of Canada. I was listening to Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel speaking about our dear little Rouhani. They both said, don't trust him. Do not trust the snake oil salesman. I have both of those clips. What I failed to do was put them in my blog, but I'll do that for you, actually. Maybe later on tonight, before I go to bed, I'm going to load those two videos, YouTube videos. You can see them on YouTube, but if you visit my blog, and the link for my blog is at the just below the slides in the show highlights, there's a link for my blog if you want to visit it. I'll try to have those two videos in there. Well, before the morning anyway. That's where you can find this article, too, about Rouhani. But it never ends. Child marriages, forced marriages. Can't do anything about it over there, but we can sure do something about it right here, and we have to do it right now. We can no longer afford to be complacent. Not any longer. It's critical mass time. We got to get busy. I'll see you back here in 3 minutes.
One, you cover up your face with this veil, Sharia. When you wear your burqa, dear, and people sneer, I wouldn't know if you're a female, Sharia. Never gonna stop or give it up. Killing infidels, always got it planned underhand. Give a lie, yell, my. She bought a bra. We lost a lot of family pride, Sharia. It all should stay a mystery in history. Beheading is the honorable way, Sharia. Never gonna stop or give it up. Killing infidels always got it planned underhand. Give a lie, yell, my.
My.
And welcome back, everybody. And just to remind you, you're listening to the Red Fox Blogger, and I'm your host, Cal Fritzy. And I want to thank my friend Jimmy C. Zultz for that, of the Jimmy C. Show, for his permission to play that music. That's all his. Now, I want to move on to something that seems a little hopeful. And let me see if I can get the country right this time. Let me see. Am I in Egypt or am I in Iran? Oh, I love my little Cal moments. I'm sure you find them absolutely adorable, too. No, you don't. But anyway, some news out of Canada, and I came across this today, and this is courtesy of Bare Naked Islam. This is really good news. There is an anti-Islamic backlash, which is growing in Canada. Now, what happened recently, a 17-year-old Muslim girl, she was strolling from the Al Noor Mosque in St. Catharines, Ontario, to a plaza across the street. She was planning on buying a drink and some snacks. Three non-Muslim teenage girls began asking her some valid questions, and one was, is it against your religion to be out walking alone? Well, it escalated into pushing and punching and ugly words being exchanged, and of course, we don't know what the Muslim said to the girls to set this off. There was blood. She went to the hospital to make sure her nose wasn't broken. And her hijab or her head bag, it was pulled. And, well, you know, you can't keep it on during a fight. So here you go. You got all these teenage girls rolling around some pizza joint at a plaza. Who knows? I don't know. But it brings on the bigger question about Islam and the backlash against it. And in this case, I'm talking about Canada. Now, this altercation, it was outside of this place, and it was pretty rough. And it was rough enough to be noticed from a nearby optometrist office. That's where witnesses called the police. But before they arrived, a woman walking a dog also stepped in. Now, two of these girls, they're charged with assault, but they cannot be named under the Youth Criminal Justice Act, which we have here enacted in Canada, because they're under the age of 18. But the girl from the mosque, she wasn't, she wasn't hurt too bad. But there is an issue about the Muslims are a little worried about this. They worry about whether or not the girl's immigrant parents might feel differently about the place they've chosen to live. Well, let's hope. You know, then there's the matter of the girl's headscarf. You know, that's the sort that covers the woman's hair. You know, it doesn't cover her face. That's the niqab, right? Yeah, so she's wearing the hijab. They're wondering if that might have factored into the incident. So now people within the Muslim community are worried. Will those girls who wear the hijab or were thinking of it, will they wonder, will people pick on me? This brought me to something else. You know, across Canada, Muslims, they have apparent reason to feel concerned about how they are perceived when other Canadians identify them by their religion. Now, there was a poll conducted by Angus Reid Public Opinion early last month. And the results, they were just made available to Maclean's magazine, and they found that attitudes towards Islam has deteriorated markedly across the country over the past 4 years. And I have the link right here. I'm going to put it in the chat room for you. You guys can take a look at that at your leisure later on. So I'm just going to pop it in there right now for you. There you go. Now, they were, like I say, Maclean's magazine, they got the results of this, and they published them. This is based on a study that's been going on for quite a while. McLean's magazine found that attitudes towards Islam, it has deteriorated markedly across the country over the past 4 years. Yeah. Well, let me see. Andrew Grenville, he's Angus Reid's chief research officer. He said, it's disturbing to see this growing level of mistrust. Brother. But the way Canadians see the other major religions, such as Christianity, Judaism, Sikhism, Hinduism, and Buddhism, hasn't changed very much at all in the same four-year period, but Islam is markedly seen in a different, more, I'd like to say, discerning light. Now, the snapshot of public opinion, it comes as the Quebec government's proposal of Charter of Values is being kicked around, and I have discussed this on the show about what the province of Quebec in Canada is doing in terms of its Charter of Values, essentially telling people no overt religious gear in the workplace, nowhere in provincial offices, nowhere in the schools. This includes things like obvious religious garb, like jewelry on the job, headgear. In other words, all religions are kind of being swept under the bus because of Islam. So there's a big deal about that going on. We know it's because of Islam that Quebec introduced this Charter of Values, which may or may not pass. We'll have to wait and see. The poll shows that the opinion in Quebec, while markedly less tolerant of religious minorities overall than in other provinces, it hasn't grown less favorable towards Muslims in recent years. No, because they've always known what Islam is. How much deeper can they go? In 2009, Angus Reid, they found that 68% of Quebecers held an unfavorable opinion of Islam. Now, asked the same question last month, the Quebec result was pretty much the same level, but it rose by 1%, so it's sitting at 69% now. But in the rest of Canada, where 46% held an unfavorable view of Islam in 2009, that has risen to 54% as of last month. Now, by comparison, 39% outside Quebec held an unfavorable opinion of Sikhism, the faith with the biggest public relations opinion problem after Islam. All the other religions were regarded unfavorably by less than 30% of Canadians. In Quebec, 48% said they would find it unacceptable for one of their children to marry a Muslim, and that's up slightly from 45% from 2009. In the rest of Canada, those who found the thought of a son or daughter marrying a Muslim unacceptable, it shot up to 32% from 24%. Rejection of the idea of a child marrying into any of the other religions was considerably lower. So you know where I'm going with this, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. Islam, we don't like you. Please leave. Get lost. Hit the road. Bye-bye. Sayonara. See you later. Don't let the door hit you on the butt on the way out. Sort of attitude. Gee, I'm so sorry. Was that Islamophobic of me? Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, well. But anyway, the findings that only Islam is viewed unfavorably by a majority of Canadians has to be deeply discouraging, of course, to those who work to improve the standing of Muslims in Canada. And here we go again. Given a string, though, of unsettling news stories in recent years, come on. From what the police call an Al-Qaeda-supported plan to derail a passenger train in Toronto, and you remember me talking about those two jokers, yeah, those two guys in Toronto who wanted to hijack a VIA rail train, command that baby into New York City and blow it up, yeah, Al-Qaeda-supported plan, that's what it was. And then we have cases like, there's a prominent case right now about whether a Muslim woman should be allowed to testify while wearing the niqab, so-called religious veil. When we hear these stories, of course the opinion shift. It's not entirely unexpected. What did they think? Now here, well, we've got ourselves a real sweetheart here. We've got ourselves a guy named Isan Gardi, and he is the Executive Director of the National Council of Canadian Muslims, formerly known as CARE Canada. Yeah, another Muslim Brotherhood front group. He says, it's surprising and it isn't. This is something that we're constantly working on. The misperceptions that people have about Islam and Muslims. It certainly doesn't help that in our political discourse, issues come up that are as sensationalized as in the media. Now, CARE Canada was founded in 2000. They were founded as the Canadian Council on American Islamic Relations. Yeah, but like I say, they've changed it to the National Council of Canadian Muslims because they want to separate themselves from their parent CARE group completely. The council, they've always focused on defending Muslim liberties. Oh, yeah, like forced child marriages. Okay. Yeah, they've always focused on defending Muslim liberties. So the legal debate in Quebec in particular over these proposed prohibitions on religious symbols in provincial workplaces is a core concern for the group. Well, don't walk around in a hefty bag. I'm sorry, I'm going off here for a minute, but I'm sorry. When I go to a provincial building, whether it be to renew my driver's license or whatever, I want to see the face of the person behind that counter. I am not going to deal with a ghost. I am not going to deal with a person dressed head to toe in black. I'm sorry, it's not going to happen. I will complain, and I will complain loudly. I support Quebec for this measure. However, it's unfortunate that they still were not brave enough to say that we are indeed targeting the Islamic so-called community. That's where I find fault in this Charter of Values proposal. Oh, here's another one that our little friend Gardi had to say. He says the council also tries to train Muslim leaders to engage more skillfully with the media on everything from handling an interview with a reporter to writing an op-ed article. The aim is to improve the way Islam is portrayed. Among the most difficult issues is veiling. The niqab is obviously an issue that's always like a lightning rod. How it plays out in the public discourse, it's come to the fore in terms of the number of stories written about it. Well, I could say, you know, no kidding, Sherlock. We've kind of figured that part out. Now, this poll, it was an online survey, and it surveyed 2,025 adults. It discovered that many Canadians who don't mind other religious clothing do object to Muslim women covering their faces. Well, of course. Asked about the burqa, a loose garment that leaves only an opening for the eyes, 90% of Quebecers and 62% of the rest of the country said they should not be allowed in public sector workplaces. The hijab got a bit of a pass. I mean, okay, cover your hair. Well, there's not too much of an issue with that, but certainly with the niqab. Now, Gardi, he acknowledges that some opposition to veiling can't be put down to outright bigotry against Muslims. Oh, well, thanks for that. Because he says, well, many do see the issue as a matter of women's rights. There's concern about whether this is something being imported and pushed on people, and we understand that concern. Still, burqas and niqabs remain relatively rare in Canada. Oh, really? Go to Toronto. The hijab is a much more common sight. And Shahina Siddiqui, she's president of the executive director of Winnipeg's Islamic Social Services Association, says she often counsels Muslim parents and their daughters about the choice to wear one or not. In some cases, Siddiqui says, the tension is over a daughter's wish to follow the tradition of the parents. But there is some reluctance. People have this impression it's the parents pushing it. Some parents do not want their daughters wearing the hijab. Siddiqui herself wears it. but only started after she emigrated to Canada from Pakistan. Bingo! Here we go. There's the money shot right there. Ladies and gentlemen, step right up and get your teddy bear. Hello! Yeah. She never wore it before she emigrated to Canada from Pakistan. I wonder if she's going to apply for a job at Abercrombie and Fitch or Disney World and file a lawsuit for discrimination when she cannot wear her lovely little hijab. Let's wait and see how that one plays out. I bet you dollars to donuts. Well, you know what? I'm not waiting. I'm going to the front of the line to get my teddy bear right now. But anyway, Siddiqui, she has a little more to say here. Her advice is, if it works for you, do it. If you feel it isn't comfortable to you, it doesn't bring you closer to the Creator, then forget it. Oh, closer to the Creator. Yeah. Now, getting back to the poll, reflection of that sort might seem remote to a teenager cornered against a brick wall outside of a strip mall convenience store. Oh, don't you love the writing here in this McLean's magazine article? Lovely stuff. A teenager cornered against a brick wall outside a strip mall. And for the Muslims facing a tide of opinion flowing against them, discussing the nuances of personal choice might seem beside the point. Whatever it takes to reverse trends in public attitudes and reduce the frequency of alarming incidences, Muslim leaders argue they shouldn't be struggling without allies. I don't think it should be up to the Muslim community alone to combat this growing anti-Islam sentiment, says our little friend Gardi. Most Canadians recognize that how we manage diversity is a discussion we should be having. How we manage diversity. Yeah. Well, you know what, Gardi? I really don't want to have a discussion about diversity because it is Sharia you want us to discuss. You want to impose your Sharia on us. So forget it. We're not buying it. Not buying it by a long shot. I was particularly interested, though, in what he had to say about coaching the media, yeah. I guess for lack of a better term, coaching. Yeah. How we had to be more media savvy. No, do you mean like maybe shut down the media altogether? Kind of like, and this is getting back to our little friend here in our in the Middle East. And now I'm bouncing back to Egypt. I was going to say Iran. Iran, Egypt, tomato, tomato. Yeah, they're completely different countries and entities, so my apologies for doing that. But now I'm going back to Egypt, and we're going back to our little friend, General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Well, he's not particularly media-friendly either. And he tried to be rather media-savvy himself. So, brother, I don't know if you're aware of this. This just came to my attention and everybody's attention not too long ago, but Sisi, he really did want to control the media. And he came up with a proposal at a meeting not too long ago when was this? I think this was about 2 years ago. I think it was, I'm trying to find the date here. I usually write these things down because that's what good radio hosts do, but I'm a very bad radio host tonight. I'm just going to play the clip. He wanted to shut down the media. He wanted to manipulate the media. Just take a listen to this.
Now, a video has emerged which appears to show Egypt's military generals deciding how to deal with the country's media. The footage released by activists shows General al-Sisi addressing senior officers of the army in the months before Mohamed Morsi was ousted from power. The recording starts with an officer urging Sisi to find a way to frighten journalists from criticizing the army.
We must reestablish red lines for the media. We need to find a new way of neutralizing them. The media in Egypt is controlled by 20 or 25 people. We should engage with these people directly and individually, either terrorize them or win them over.
I know how to win them over, but tell me, how do you suggest I terrorize them? I want to tell you that we've been concerned with controlling the media from the very first day the army took over power in 2011. And we suffered a lot because in order to achieve what you're talking about, you need to have influence. It's not as simple as just setting up a committee or a task force. It takes a long time before you're able to affect and control the media. We're working on this and we're achieving more positive results, but we're yet to achieve what we want.
Now, isn't that special? Yeah, he was supposed to be, what, a reformist there in Egypt? Yeah, that didn't take very long, didn't it? No. Yeah, he wants to control the media. Is that what our little friend here in Canada also has in mind? I don't know. I'll tell you something right now, though. I am not concerned about the backblow that Islam is receiving in Canada. Not by a long shot. Not at all. It's a long time in coming. So as far as I'm concerned, CARE Canada, of whom I will still recognize them, we don't care because we're not taking it anymore. And Gardaí, pretty funny. You want to control the media? You want to be more media savvy, i.e. control the media. I didn't realize it, but I'm down to my last, pretty much my last 15 minutes of talking points here. There was one other thing I wanted to share with you, and this is totally unrelated, but it is in a way. We've been hearing a lot of stories about Islam arrives on the Western shores and how they bring about their cultures and their backwards ways. We're dealing with the niqab, hijab issue. We've been discussing forced child marriages and how some of these children are actually disappearing from the West and how it could happen to us if we are not careful. Do you know that little girls, they're being coached to put spoons in their underwear before boarding the plane so that it sets off an alarm? If they're concerned about the family trip to Pakistan. Yeah, they're being taught to do that. Yeah. But one final thing I want to share with you. We import these people, okay? How is it that they're not screened? It is virtually impossible to screen these immigrants coming over here. Virtually. We do not know what belief systems they're still hanging on to. We do not know whether they're practicing their Sharia here behind our backs. They come over here, they're supposed to take a few, civil citizenship courses and take some questionnaires. Do you believe in Sharia law? No way, man. That's why I left Pakistan, to come over here to get away from that. Yeah, get away from it. Yeah. Well, we find out in short time that many of them, they lie to us like you wouldn't believe. Yeah, the good old Takiya popping his ugly head up again. We had an incident here this week, a Somali, quote-unquote, Canadian. He beheaded his four sons. Yeah. This happened, he went back to Somalia. They arrested Omar Hassan. He's 60 years old. After the children aged 11, 9, 7, and 6 were killed Monday. The slayings happened in the central town at Bella Duane. Okay, you know what? Don't even get me started on the pronunciations here. Bella Duane. That's about 33 kilometers north of the capital of Mogadishu. Now, the mother of the four boys, she doesn't know what happened. She said that they were born in Kenya, but they were Canadians because the father was Canadian. Okay. So I don't know what happened here, guys. Did he snap? Who knows? Oh, I got a clip here. I'll let you take a listen to it. She'll play for me. Come on, baby. It's not cooperating. Come on.
This man with ties to Alberta, possibly to Calgary, has been charged with horrific crimes in his homeland.
Police in that country say Omar Hassan beheaded his four sons, the oldest seven, the youngest just three. The 60-year-old was arrested north of Mogadishu, apparently, after turning himself in. Our Chris App is covering this story. So Chris, Hassan's wife says he used to work here.
She says he was a cab driver for decades in Calgary and elsewhere in Canada, but that he moved back to Somalia several years ago after they got married. Now, the city of Calgary has no record of anyone by that name ever being granted a taxi license here. We also spoke to several local cab companies who also said that they had no trace of him in their records. However, nobody seems to be disputing the fact that he did spend many years in Canada. His wife says she hoped to eventually move here with their children. She says she's obviously devastated by what happened.
He's killed them, poor children. Knife, he's killed knife, and all of them, they're dying. They died, all of them.
Now, we also talked to Canadian Foreign Affairs today. They said they are aware of this case, but haven't been asked to be involved in any way, Tara.
All right, Chris, thank you.
Yeah, a Somali-Canadian. Ain't that special? These are the people. These are the best and the brightest. This is the best we can import? Seriously? These are your immigrants from the Middle East, from North Africa, from Asia. Halt Islamic immigration. Put a moratorium on Islamic immigration. And get rid of official multiculturalism. Please, Canada, it's a failed social experiment. We have seen in one generation, only one generation, it has taken for us to see that multiculturalism is a failed endeavor. Guys, I'm going to leave you right now. Just a few programming notes. On Monday, Tim Burton will be joining me, and that's on Monday, my show. As you know, I tape my shows twice a week. Mondays at 3 p.m. and always here on Fridays at 7 p.m. But get out there and listen to all the shows because they are there. We have to pay attention to what's going on out there because, believe me, it is mass Islamity and we have to stop the insanity. Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you for joining me tonight. Have yourselves a wonderful weekend. I will see you back here Monday, 3 p.m. Eastern Time. Bye-bye.
Oh,
also want to thank Bigfoot and Doc for joining me. And here you go, guys.